This is May 4th, 2008, and today we'll be having our annual memorial service for Roshi Kaplow, who died on May 6th. This is the closest Sunday to that date. And I'll take up a koan today in which I will make many references to Roshi Kaplow. This is from the collection of koans called the Book of Serenity, or Shoyo Roku, number 14, and it's called Ho Offers Tea. First, I'll read the case. Ho, the attendant, asked Deshan, "Where have all the Buddhas and ancestors of the past gone?" Deshan replied, "What did you say?" Ho said, "I commanded a fine racehorse to spring out, but only a lame tortoise appeared." Deshan was silent. Next day, when Deshan came from his bath, Ho offered him tea. Deshan gave his shoulder a gentle pat. Ho said, "The old boss has noticed for the first time." Deshan was again silent. The Shoyo Roku is generally the third collection of main collection of koans worked on after the Mumon Kan and the Blue Cliff record. It consists of 100 cases, about a third of which are repeats from one of the other two collections. It was compiled in the 12th century. Well, it was compiled before that by a great, one of the co-founders of what we call the Soto school. His name was Tiantong Hongji, and then later in the 12th century, a master by the name of Wan Song had it published after adding his own commentaries. And it's a distinctly Soto collection. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, there are two in Japan. There are two main schools of Zen. There's the Soto school and the Rinzai school, and they have many the same. It's the Rinzai school mainly that works on koans. Although there's this third school of which we are sort of part of, which is sort of an integration of these two schools. It was called the Harada Yasutani line, or the Sanbo Kyodan, as it's called in Japanese. Even though we use the Soto ancestral line, there are two different ancestral lines. One is Soto, one is Rinzai. We use the Soto. We face the wall the way they do in the Soto school. But we use koans for that is for people who want to work on koans. These two schools have different koans when you do work on them, and this is more of a Soto collection, the Shoyo Roku. I won't take the time to read material about this Deshan. Deshan is the Chinese name. He's a Chinese master. These are almost all Chinese masters in all the koan collections. But many of you may know him better by his Japanese name, which is Toksan. Toksan was this raging bull who stormed off. He studied the Diamond Sutra. Became some kind of a great aficionado of the Diamond Sutra, and he set off. He heard that there was this school. He was he was a not in the Zen school, not in the, let's use the Chinese name, Chan. He was not in the Chan school. He was in another one that involved a lot of sutra study. And he heard about this these Chan people who said that you become a Buddha instantly through awakening to your Buddha nature. And he became indignant, and he charged off with his Diamond Sutra commentaries on his back and encountered this old woman on the road. And she innocently asked him, "What have you got there, big boy?" And he drew himself up and said, "My good woman, these are the Diamond Sutra and its commentaries." And she said, "Well, now," she was selling, let's call it donuts. She was selling cakes, donuts on the road, and he wanted to have a donut and a cup of coffee. And she said, "Well, look, tell you what I'll do. I'm not even going to try to impersonate her the way Roshi Kaplow did, because it's just, well, I want it to stand. I think I could do a decent job of it. I want to have it just stand as it was for those of you who heard him impersonate this old woman. So I'll just play it straight." So she said to him, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you a donut and a cup of coffee if you can answer a question for me." And the great Dashan said, "Why, of course." And she said, "In the Diamond Sutra," now this is not what he was expecting, is it? "In the Diamond Sutra it says that past mind is unattainable, present mind is unattainable, future mind is unattainable. Now, that having been said, tell me, Venerable One, with which mind will you refresh yourself?" The literal translation for these cakes were mind refreshers. So she was playing on that double meaning. And she said, "With which of these minds will you be refreshed?" He could see that she had the drop on him. And he had no realization. He was a scholar, a magnificent, brilliant scholar who had dedicated his monastic career to studying this sutra in particular, which, by the way, is particularly admired in Chan or Zen. He was dumbstruck. He couldn't answer her. And after standing there and maybe saying "Hamana, hamana, 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 hamana," he said to her, this is all that comes down to is in the story, he said to her, "Is there a Zen master nearby?" And she said, "Why, yes, there is. Go see Ryutan, and he should be able to help you." And then he went to however many hours or weeks it took him to get there, he went to this monastery, and this was a very illustrious Zen master, and they had a little exchange when he got there. And then this master, Ryutan, must have seen that he had good material there with this guy, exceptional potential, because he sat down and he spent some time, probably hours, I would guess, hours discussing the Diamond Sutra with him. That's pretty unusual reception. Especially one of these ancient giant monasteries with hundreds of monks, that he would sit down right off with a newcomer like that and give him that kind of time. One of Roshi Kaplow's teachings, private teachings, comes to mind as I'm saying this. He said sometimes. He was. This is in context of working with students. Sometimes you have to give a student what he wants in order to have him want what you have to give him. So Ryutan spent all this time with him, and then night was falling, it got dark, and Rutan said, "Well, it is late now, you better get going." So Dushan stood up, was about to leave, and opened the door and saw that it was pitch black out, and he turned to Rutan and said, "It's dark outside." And so Rutan lit a candle and reached out to hand it to Dushan, and just as Dushan reached to take it, Rutan blew it out. And at that moment, Dushan came to enlightenment. Can you appreciate the significance of that darkness? It is not unrelated to today's koan. Well, Dushan, in those early, his early years as a enlightened man, monk, was known for his fiery temperament and his stick, his use of the stick on his students. But later, he became much more mellow, as most people do, and that's where we pick up today with today's story and today's koan, is where he was much older. We can guess that he might have been at least in his 70s. And he's approached by his attendant, Huo. And Huo asks him, "Where have all the Buddhas and ancestors of the past gone?" Now, we can be sure that Huo is not asking for historical instruction. And that's the first point of the koan. Where have all the Buddhas and ancestors of the past gone? Yeah, where have they all gone? Where is Roshi Kaplow gone? He's no beginner, this Huo. To be the attendant of the great Dushan, when Dushan was in an advanced age, Huo, this attendant, must have been advanced in his practice, at least in one way. Advanced, perhaps, in the way that Dushan was when he first had his enlightenment. So Dushan's reply, "What'd you say?" They didn't have hearing aids in those days. Maybe they had one of those horns that you hold up in next to your ear, but just that. What's that? By the way, this free association here, we are soon, hopefully soon, to get a an induction loop here in this Zendo, as well as the one at Chapin Mill, so that people with the right kind of earpiece can hear any talk, my talk or any talk that is spoken into a microphone. This is the second point of the koan. And then Huo replies, "I commanded a fine racehorse to spring out, but only a lame tortoise appeared." There's a translation of the full Shoyoroku that includes the commentaries of Wansong as well as the verse of the of Tiantong Hongji. Wansong says here, referring to the attendant at this point, he says, "He is like trying to take the jewel from under the jet-black dragon's jaw at the depths of the abyss, getting there just when the dragon is asleep. If the dragon wakes up, he'll surely be chopped into mincemeat." And to that somewhat outrageous statement by Huo, that provocative statement by Huo, Deshan was silent. Another translation says here, "Deshan, let it rest." Most of you know that koans are structured in such a way that we have the barest, just the barest outline given to us in the case itself, and that we're left to intuit what's going on behind the words. It always strikes me as it's like getting a new coloring book, a child's coloring book with just the outlines, and then it's up to the student to color it in, to see into the minds and the hearts of these monks, to appreciate what's really going on here. And in the case of silence, all kinds of different things could be going on. Deshan was silent. This reminds me of a monk who once asked the great Joshu, "Is there any Buddhist teaching in the remote mountains when no one is present?" And Joshu said, "Large rocks are large, small rocks are small." There's an American novelist of the last century by the name of Bernard Malamud who once said, "He answered nothing. If you failed to do the right thing, talk was useless." What helps with this koan is knowing who Deshan was, that he was this great great vessel of realization. And we can be, that helps to know that. He's not just asleep at the switch here. Although that would also make an interesting koan. If he was, it was his nap time and he was just nodding out. I think back of to Roshi's silences. I don't need to keep saying Roshi Kaplow. If I'm saying Roshi now, I'm not talking about myself. There's so much I learned over the years. There's so much that a teacher sees that he or she doesn't comment on. the first direct experience I had with that was when I was new at the center. This was about 1973 or something like that, and on staff. And Roshi mistakenly thought that one of the doors that was supposed to be, this was when we had just this house. So the door to 7AP, right outside the Zendo here, by the shoe cubby holes, that was, beyond that was just driveway. It was outdoors. And there was a bar, one of those, it was a fire door, so it had one of those bars that you just push to open the door. And mechanics was never one of Roshi's strong suits. And he pretty much passed that on to his Dharma successor. but he had apparently pushed, he was going out, and he pushed the door. Instead of pushing on the bar, he pushed just on the wood. The other way. He pushed on the bar, and it opened. And I don't know, this may be a little garbled, this part of it. But somehow there was a misunderstanding on his part where he thought that that there was something wrong. And then he turned to me and said, isn't this door supposed to be locked? And standing there in front of the door, I started explaining to him. I said, well, you see, the door has this thing where when you push the latch, and then he wanted clarification. And then as we went on, and I got more and more involved in my explanation, instead of just pushing the handle and seeing the door open, he just stood there listening, and now his eyes were twinkling as he said, so what exactly do you mean? And so I went on explaining, and finally he just said, he's murmured, after I turned and took about six steps, and then, oh, shit, why didn't I just push the door open and show him? Much, much later, when he was much older, we both were, I discovered that sometimes when we would get into some dispute about something, and I spent enough time at his side to get into arguments now and then with him, I would be arguing one thing, he would say something, I would argue the other side of it. It was a matter of fact, it wasn't opinion, it was a matter of fact. I would state what I thought the fact was, and he would just let it go, and gonna go on to the next thing. You know, where's that book I asked you to get or something? And then later I found that he knew what the fact was. He just didn't want to argue. He saw no point in it. He saw no value to trying to prove himself right. I think when he was a younger man, that was not the case. When we had a dedication of the Buddha Hall in, the mid-70s, I was assigned the job of picking up another Zen. We invited two other Zen teachers from the Northeast to come for the dedication, and I was the kind of attendant, local attendant, who picked up one of these teachers. Who came with three attendants of his own. And when I drove them back to the airport at the end of the weekend, one of the attendants from who came with the teacher, one of the attendants in the back seat who hadn't seen Roshi in years, said, boy, has he changed? He's so much quieter. And then she said, he used to be so aggressive. And Roshi pretty much admitted as such. Various times over the years when I was with him, that he used to be more like the young Dashun, much more assertive and spoiling for a fight. And then here, over the years, he would just, even knowing he was right about this or that matter of fact, he would just let it go. He told the story of when he was in Japan and freezing all the time. He could never get warm. You know, Japan has no central heating, and in the winter it's like living in a garage all winter. So it's not, you know, it's not zero, but it's can be as low as 30 degrees, 40 degrees, and he always said the only way he could really get warm to his bones was in the Japanese bath, soaking tub. And he told of how once he slipped out of the monastery, Hoshinji, and went into town to one of the public baths to get warm. He was AWOL. You're not supposed to leave the walls of the monastery without permission. But he was desperate to thaw himself out, so he went in, had his bath, and on his way back to town, he bumped into Harada Roshi. And Harada Roshi, he said, made nothing of it. He asked him how he was, and Roshi, Roshi made up some lie about why he'd gone into town. And Harada Roshi listened, and probably with his eyes twinkling, and he probably said, "Sodeska, sodeska, is that so? Is that so?" And he just went on. Roshi appreciated this so much that Harada Roshi had just let it rest. And he never, wasn't punished, you know, later. It's just Harada Roshi no doubt knew he was already in his 80s. He knew that as a foreigner, as a gaijin, who at the age of 41 or 42 or whatever Roshi was, it was quite a feat for him to manage to stay in the monastery at all, stay in training. He couldn't speak Japanese, hardly knew a word. He couldn't sit in any posture on a mat. They had to find him a chair for him to sit on. He was a wreck. That for him to hang in there like that, he would just let it go this time. Maybe other times he was taken to task for breaking rules of the monastery, but this time, Harada Roshi just let it rest. This is, I think, more appreciated in Asia, this non-confrontive, yielding style. Not that's preferred by any means. There are plenty of times when it's called for to confront someone or to be confronted. And to not do so is to fail the person, to not confront someone who needs some confrontation. But there's a time for everything. I commanded a fine racehorse to spring out, but only a lame tortoise appeared. The Shan was silent. The Buddha said, "The strength of a religious teacher is his patience." There's a great passage by, I'm afraid I don't know, Nurbakshi, the Nurbakshi sect. My guess is it's Sufi, but it doesn't matter. Let's make it Zen. Why not? It's about the teacher, the role of the teacher. It says the teacher is like a master craftsman in a country where people want craft work, but yet imagine that it is performed, shall we say, in the dark. He is like an eagle in a cage, deprived of his main capacity of flight and sight, but employed by idlers for visual amusement. He is like a lion in a pit, baited by the ignorant and admired by those who like a tawny coat. He is like the ant who invented a house and hopes that he can attain his object of inducing man to copy him. He is like the crow showing man how to bury his dead while man watches perplexed, knowing that he can learn, but not imagining what it is that he has to learn from what the crow is doing. I came to appreciate how Roshi himself could read his students' silences. And that he would notice silences. He would notice those who didn't speak up at a meeting or something. It's kind of a noticing the negative, noticing the reverse side. Anyone can notice the ones who speak up, the loudmouths and the complainers and the flatterers. But I came to see how he noticed those who said nothing. And even that silence can be understood in different ways. There were times when one can appreciate that silence, and then other times when one can it can provoke concern. I think a couple of times long before I became a teacher, he said to me, "Watch out for the quiet ones." The ones who are good at suppressing their anger. In this first silence of Deshan, in response to the insult, Wan Song says, "Deshan keeps deaf and plays dumb, but even so, he gets the advantage unseen." So then, the next day, the scene shifts. Deshan had a bath, and he comes, gets out of the bath, gets dressed, and his attendant, Wo, offers him tea. This would be, no doubt, part of the ritual, the normal course of things, that the attendant would be ready and then would offer him some tea. And Deshan gave his shoulder a gentle pat. This line, when I first read this koan, this line, it just flooded me with memories of Roshi. It wasn't often that Roshi touched me. was one time in particular. When he did, it meant a lot, because he was so harsh and critical so much of the time. There was one memory in particular from this was when I was receptionist. This was 1975, and now we had 5AP. I was in the reception office there, and at that time the receptionist sat facing the window with our back to the room. Most of the staff at desks sat with their back to the room, just to cut out unnecessary visual involvement in things. And behind me, Roshi came out of his quarters, which were the abbot's quarters now, and he had some discussion with someone about something they weren't sure of. They were trying to figure out what was the fact of the matter. And I naturally overheard them. I was in the same room, and I turned around and I offered what I thought was something that would clear it up. And he was in a bad mood, and he just wheeled on me and said, "Oh, be quiet, you don't know what you're talking about." And I don't even remember whether it was justified or not, but I sure felt stung by it. But what was remarkable for me at the time was this was just after he had passed me on Mu, and I'd been stung enough by him to know how that felt. This time, it went right through me. It was almost nothing, and I remember just being so pleased that he could, you know, wail on me like that, and I realized that's his issue. He probably didn't get much sleep the night before. Roshi had a lot of problems with insomnia, and something which I really never fully appreciated when I was working with him, and how much that is a factor in one's mood. But that for the first time, his scolding, not that I just dismissed it, ignored it, but that it just went through me. It was very heartening at a time when I was wondering what the heck really had happened to me passing Mu. But now this is what I'm getting to. Like a minute later, when he finished with that person he'd been talking with, he came up behind me and touched me on the shoulder and just kept going. And that was very rare that he did that. I mean, when he would do that, he'd be talking to you and he'd just touch your forearm, you know, talking face to face, and he would just, but this time to come up and touch me on the shoulder from the back was very, very much appreciated. I didn't need it as far as feeling badly about myself, but it was such a generous and warm gesture of apology, really. And it was enough. He didn't need to apologize verbally. I got it. Is that what Dashan's, is that what's behind Dashan's giving his attendant a gentle pat? Another point. This koan is loaded with different points to intuit. For whom did Dashan give that gentle pat to his attendant? I have another passage here from Pope John the 23rd, who, I think this applies to teaching as well. He said, "See everything, overlook a great deal, correct a little. So he pats him on the shoulder, and then Huo says, "The old boss has noticed for the first time." What about that? Deshan was again silent. This, in terms of this second silence, Wan Song, in his commentary, says, "Deshan usually thrashed the wind and beat the rain, hollering at the Buddhas and reviling the patriarchs. This monk's errors filled the sky. Why did Deshan let him go? What is hardly realized is that he wrestled down oxen without using rope, killed people without using a sword. How many has he ever let go?" My guess is that Huo, the attendant, later revisited this, his own responses to Deshan, and had a whole different insight into Deshan's silences and his touching him on the shoulder. I've certainly had plenty of times when I've, in the last, not just the last 4 years since Roshi died, but well, long before that, ever, especially since becoming a teacher myself, when I've come to understand and I think a much deeper way Roshi's silences, as well as his words, his responses in different situations. His humanness. Who's to say that when Huo, was jerking his chains, that Deshan didn't feel some pang of pain? We want so much to make enlightened people into special people, superheroes, preferably, and a silence. Silence is like an empty canvas that we imagine that, yes, a superhero, or ideally a superhero with no normal human emotions or feelings. But that said, in this case, I would be very surprised if Huo felt any offense, took any offense at his attendant's comments. I think of the line from Affirming Faith in Mind: "When this one mind rests undisturbed, then nothing in the world offends." My bet would be that Huo's mind was resting undisturbed, and that his attendant's words just rolled off him like water off a duck's back. But leaving aside this great master and his attendant, what about oneself? If we have feelings, we acknowledge them. In Zen, we don't want to either deny our feelings or wallow in them. Wherever we are in this practice, in this path, to face what we are, who we are at any given time, our reactions, and then move on, not foreclosing our nature, our way. What we find through ongoing practice, long practice, is less reactivity to people and to things. But this does not come easily. People who have a tendency to react to the comments of others may find that it may be many years before they can be as free of these reactions as they might want to be. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.